You are listening to a sermon recorded in 2007 at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
I've had a dreadful flu, and I'm still not quite back together again. It ruined my midterm break, which I was looking forward to for other purposes, but it's back to the salt mines tomorrow, if I'm still alive. I'd like to thank Evan, particularly, but also the entire community, for allowing me to come back and speak to you again. I must have done something right the first time, otherwise, you know, that would have been it. what I want to talk about today is prayer. Now, I know you've had talks about this in the past, but I want to do it from a particular perspective, which is the Catholic one. Catholic prayer is chiefly ritual prayer. I mean, a lot of individuals will have their own private devotion, either from printed prayer books or prayers they make up themselves. But the communal worship is ritual, and the central ritual of Catholic life is the Mass, the celebration of Christ's passion, death, and sacrifice of himself for our salvation. One of the great ironies, I think it's ironic anyway, is that although the Mass is the central, the pivotal part of Catholic religious life, nobody knows what the word means. We know where it comes from. It comes from the closing formula of the Latin Mass, in which the priest would turn towards the congregation and say, after the final blessing, "Ite, go, missa est." And this word, missa, is the one that produces mass in English, la messe in French, la missa in Italian, in Spanish and Portuguese, and la messa in Italian. And it's the central core of Catholic worship, and we don't know what it means. We know what the phrase means. It means go, it, something feminine, we don't know what, has been sent. But what has been sent? It has been speculated that the phrase really means go, the congregation, which is a feminine word in Latin, congregatio, missa est, is dismissed, you know, go home, sort of thing. I'm not totally convinced of that. I think it refers to the sacrifice of the Mass, the central part, the core of the liturgy, which is the consecration and then communion. And that in Latin is called an oblatio, a gift. And since Christ's sacrifice was a gift for mankind, my guess is that what the priest is really saying at the end of the whole performance is, go home, the gift has been sent. There's nothing more to do until next time round. Now, in spite of having been the core of Catholic worship right from the early church, during the years of the Latin Mass, there was very, very little participation on the part of the congregation. You went to church, you listened to a priest mumbling in some language that you could not understand. Occasionally there'd be an amen to say, but basically nothing new. If you knew Latin, then you could sort of figure out what was going on. In modern times, prayer books, the missal, the mass book, would have been printed in Latin with the translation on the other side so you could follow it in English. But a lot of people simply engaged in private, internal devotion during the Mass because they couldn't follow what was going on because of the language problem, so they would say their own prayers, and either from the prayer book that they would bring with them or simply by memory or whatever. As a result of the liturgical reforms of Vatican II in the late 50s and early 60s, we got what was called initially the Dialogue Mass, still in Latin, slightly revised format, but the congregation was now expected to participate in certain facets of it, to recite prayers, to give responses to different parts of the Mass. And then subsequently, once we got the English version, then participation has become much more public. And that's what you do. There are very, very few people, except the very old, who now use Mass as a format for private devotion. It's very much a participatory event. And I'd just like to walk you through the sections of it. I think everybody should have a copy of the handout. We always start, I should point out, that the Mass does not admit of very much variation. The text is pretty much fixed. So you're not, the priest is not really at liberty to make up things as he goes along. It's very much ritual. Okay. We start with what is called the greeting in the penitential rite, a short rite at the beginning, which in which the congregation, along with the priest for that matter, publicly confess to their sinfulness, both towards God and to each other. It's not a confession of individual sin, that's done in private confession. It's a general admission of sinfulness and of having troubled our neighbour, if you like. And then there's a request for forgiveness through the intercession of all the angels and saints. This typically concludes, except during Advent and Lent, with the public recitation or singing of the great hymn, the Gloria, Glory to God in the Highest. And that concludes the greeting and penitential rite and leads into what is called the Liturgy of the Word, which is very much what we've had here today, readings from Scripture, but we're not at liberty to pick whichever reading we feel like. They're all set for each day of the year, and they go in a two-year cycle, so cycle A, cycle B. And the same applies to the Anglican Church. They follow the entirely the same cycle. So if I go to Mass, for example, at Our Lady's over the road, and then decide that I'd like a bit of Anglican worship and go up to St. Helens, I'll get the same readings, the same stuff, and very much the same sort of homily as well. So the first reading is always from the Old Testament, and that is read typically nowadays by a member of the congregation who has been appointed as a lector. There will then be the singing of a psalm. And again, this is fixed for each day of the week. You can't just pick out whichever psalm you feel like. The second reading will be from the New Testament, and again, fixed for each day of the week. Typically, the two readings, the Old Testament reading and the New Testament reading, will have been picked by whoever makes up the missal, of course, by Rome, in such a way that there's a connection, a thematic connection. There's the view that the Old Testament, of course, prefigures the New, and the reading is always set up to try and give some sort of example of that type of prefiguration. Second reading, also done by a member of the congregation, a lector. There will be a gospel acclamation sung, and this is usually a verse from a psalm, just a short piece, and then a reading from the gospel, which is done by the priest. And again, the gospel text will be fixed for each day of the year. So the priest is not at liberty to say, I don't want that one, let's try something else. You know, it's actually an infraction of canon law if he does that. After the gospel, we get the homily. These are required on Sundays by canon law, and they're expected to be some sort of commentary on the readings of the day to try and draw the threads together and make sense of the connections and all that sort of thing. After the homily, we get the recital of the creed. It's not quite the same version that we had this morning, but it essentially says the same thing. We normally, in this archdiocese, use the Apostles' Creed. On high holidays, they'll most likely use the Nicene Creed, the longer form. The Nicene Creed is the norm in Great Britain. I've never heard them use the Apostles' Creed at Mass. And I think in most dioceses in the United States, it's the long creed that is recited, at least in my experience. This is communal prayer, so the entire congregation joins in with reciting the creed. This is followed by what is called here the prayers of the faithful. Now, this is an addition. It's a revisiting of an old type of communal prayer, which used to be common in the medieval pre-Reformation church before the Council of Trent reformed the liturgy. The Anglicans kept it, and they used to call it, and may still call it, the bidding prayers, or the general intercessions, or the prayers of the faithful. These are typically a sheet of paper that has a number of prayers typed on it, that are prepared generally in the rectory, either by the priest or a pastoral assistant, and they are read by one of the lectors. And they tend to follow a set format. First of all, prayers for the church and for the leaders of the Christian churches and the great world religions is the formula that we use. Then there'll be prayers for, well, political leaders and war-torn countries, this sort of thing. Then a prayer which has to do perhaps with some specific issue in this province or in this country or in the world that we need to address. Then there will be prayers for the sick, or a prayer for the sick of the parish and the sick in general, with names named if there are any people who are particularly ill. And then prayers for the dead, generally, and also for specific members of the parish if there have been any deaths during the week. And then there's a final prayer which the priest will say. Now, in some small communities, about the size of this, they have successfully managed to get people to put in spontaneous prayers of the faithful. They're not just on a piece of paper, but there's a pause at the end for anyone else to put in a particular prayer request or whatever. Obviously, in a cathedral like Holy Rosary, where you might have 1,000 people, it's a bit problematic to get this sort of thing going. But in smaller groups, it works quite well. But it's taken a while to get people accustomed to speaking up in church. In church you keep quiet. That was the tradition we were brought up in. And now there's this encouragement for greater participation and verbalization. From the prayers of the faithful, we go into the essence of the Mass, the part that is called the offertory, which begins with a ritual washing of hands by the priest, and then the preparation of the gifts, that is, the bread and wine, for the consecration. And that leads into the canon of the Mass, which is where the gifts are, in fact, consecrated in preparation for communion. And this then leads, after the recital of the Lord's Prayer, leads right into the communion rite, where people receive the bread and wine. Until very recently, in the Catholic Church, it was only the bread that was distributed. But nowadays, on Sundays at least, and high holidays, you can take both kinds. The Anglicans, of course, kept the two going all the time. And then, after the communion rite, the final prayer the blessing and the dismissal, very short ceremony. Sometimes it's that point in the service where announcements are made before the final dismissal. So it's a format that basically admits of no variation, where the only things that change are the readings, which change every day, and the prayers of the faithful too will change, but otherwise you're getting the same thing all the time, and it's the central ritual of the Catholic Church. In fact, most, as I said, most Catholic public prayer is ritualistic. Another example here that I'll just go through very quickly is the Divine Office, which is very much associated with monastic life. So if you reside, for example, in a Benedictine monastery, your day used to be organized around these so-called canonical hours, which reflect the old Roman way of dividing the day up. So you'd start early in the morning, and by early in the morning I mean, you know, 3 a.m., something like that, for matins, the early morning prayer. Then at dawn you would have lauds, which means praise, so it's praise on for the rising of the sun. Then you'd have prime, first hour, at 6 a.m., then terse, the third hour, at 9 a.m., then sext, I think I got that right.
Never before noon.
At noon, and then known, not non, known, which means the ninth hour, at 3 p.m., then Vespers, the evening prayer, from 4 till 6. I don't mean it lasted from 4 till 6, it was anywhere between 4 and 6. And then Compline, which means basically the completing of the cycle, the final prayer before retiring for the night. So this is your routine in your Benedictine monastery. Your life revolves around this cycle, and in between each of these canonical hours, you then go back to work, brewing or distilling or whatever. The Second Vatican Council, the one I referred to earlier, late 50s, early 60s, reformed this system, and essentially Lords and Vespers are to be regarded as the principal hours, and you can omit prime, and matins don't have to be early morning, they can be said any time during the day. And the secular clergy, that is those who work in parishes, may choose to recite any one of these, the terse, sext, not sect, or known, little hours, instead of all three of them. And they typically will do it in private, in their private chapel. You'll virtually never hear any of these things done in a Catholic parish church. It's very much a monastic event. The Anglicans still have typically matins and vespers. You'll find that posted on the boards outside Anglican churches, you know, the hours for matins and vespers, and that's a fairly regular thing. But in the Catholic Church, it's limited almost entirely nowadays to monasteries. So that the laity is not constrained by this cycle. It's just what we call the regular clergy, those who those who live under a monastic rule or regula. Another ritual prayer is the rosary, which I'm sure you've heard of. I'll show you an example of a rosary bead. Okay, nice colours in this case. Crucifix at this end, and then you have two small beads, three big ones, and then five groups of 10 with a big one in between each group. These are called decads, and won't waste your time going through all of this. You've got it on the handout. It explains the system. Now, a lot of people in the old days of the Latin Mass would use this for their own private devotion during the Mass, while the priest was getting on with his Latin business, and the laity, on the whole, didn't know what was going on. So it was, and they're still very much used for private devotion. You know, you can put them in your pocket and go through them while you're on the bus going to UBC, you know, this sort of thing. It's also very much a common feature as public devotion, where they will go through the whole of these 15 decades. It takes about 20 minutes to half an hour. And when it's done in a group in church, you get this sort of rhythmic chant-like effect, which is not unlike the sort of effect you'd get, for example, from Gregorian chant, or from this new what is known as Taizé prayer, which comes from a French monastery, and which is not limited to Catholic communities. And when you get this sort of rolling rhythm going, I think what happens is that it causes an increase in alpha brain waves, something like that. It makes it easier to connect with the divine or with the newliness. And it's in many ways the same sort of process as reciting a mantra over and over again. You get this sort of rhythm going, which brings about an altered state of consciousness. And this is very much what happens when you get the rosary done as a public form of ritual prayer. And I'll just finish off with a couple of words about the mystic way. The Western Church has always been very suspicious of mysticism because it involves what they regard as the dangers of private revelation as opposed to church teaching. All the great mystics, right from the Middle Ages up to the present time in the West, have been seriously investigated by church authorities to make sure that they were in fact orthodox in terms of their beliefs and whatnot, that they were not going to be preaching false doctrine, if you like. When I talk to my students at UBC about the great Spanish mystics, St. Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross, who were prolific writers about the mystic way, I tell them that mysticism is a little bit like, the mystic way is a little bit like booting up your computer, except it goes the other way around. When you switch on your computer, the program, the system, systematically goes through all the little programs that it has to make sure that everything is in place. And when it's satisfied, then it's blah, 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 blah. Welcome to Windows. Okay. Now, the mystic way essentially goes the opposite direction. What you're trying to do is unboot all your systems. And it's one of the great paradoxes of the religious life. The technique, insofar as you can talk about a technique, is to systematically try and eradicate all rational function up here so that you're not thinking at all, and then all the sub-rational functions should be closed down until, if you're lucky, you're even unaware of your body. It's the total abnegation of being through contemplative process. But the great irony is, as the mystics have attested, that the minute you achieve this state of nothingness, this great cloud of unknowing, all of a sudden you know you are more fully, and you know you're face to face with God without any rational or physical intervention. It's divine revelation. Now, of course, you can't force it, and the mystics know this. They probably had, at some early stage in their lives, perhaps when they were teenagers, the first inkling of the experience, and they worked hard and long to try and recreate it. And they call this long, hard work the dark night of the soul, where they can't re-achieve the divine vision. But of course, a lot of it has to do with God. You can't force him. And it's when he's ready for them to re-experience it that they do, not because they're pushing it hard. But it's an interesting process, not limited simply to Christianity. And there was a great outburst of it in the 16th century in Europe, but not just among the Christian groups. There were Jewish mysticism and Islamic mysticism as well. And finally, talk too long, sorry. Other types of worship experiences. I, on the whole, find private devotion rather hard going. A lot of the prayer books that are published in the Catholic Church, you know, we don't have a Book of Common Prayer like the Anglicans do. They're books produced by the different religious orders. And the traditional ones that I was brought up with, I found to be a bit, I don't know how should you put it, a bit cloying. The prayers which would be forever going on about gentle Jesus, meek and mild. This seems to me to be an invention of Italian mothers who want to see in him, you know, their ideal little boy. Well, it doesn't wash historically. Sure, he was good with kids. He was very compassionate with sinners. But he was hard on the hypocrites and violent even with the moneylenders. So this sort of meek and mild routine seems to me a falsification, and I could never really get away with it. But I have no problem worshipping God in nature, and particularly if you can get away from the city on a clear summer's night, get away from the light pollution and the air pollution, somewhere up in the mountains, where the sky is absolutely full of the universe, with the Milky Way splashed across it, and where you almost reach out and pull a star out of the heavens. Now, in that sort of circumstance, I am awestruck, and I don't have to say anything. I can just stand there and worship God in his firmament. And if you haven't tried that, you should try it sometime. It's a remarkable experience of just being part of this immense and glorious creation which is produced for us. So thank you very much for listening. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.